In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about staying motivated, improving onboarding, improving conversions, and more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 369. But before we dive into the intro, Mike, I have a question for you.
Oh, boy.
Why doesn't McDonald's sell hot dogs?
They have, actually. They've done a bunch of experiments with selling hot dogs. And I think that I've seen them in Texas, but I've also seen them in other places where at certain times of the year, like they'll just kind of test it out to see whether it's going to work or not. And it's usually just like a limited edition item, but they have tried it. I know that. And now you know.
Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
I'm Mike.
Really?
I had something in my throat.
Yeah. What happened with your voice? And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. Oh, this is a good week for the intro.
Oh, perfect. Yes.
I realized something. I went back because I was on, flying to and from Europe, and I downloaded just some older episodes, like in the 200s, because I just wanted to, kind of check out what we were talking about back then. And the intro is different. It was like building software products or something, instead of building, launching, and growing. And I think I like our new one. It was also like, for a long time, it was just like developers building software products. And now it's like developers, designers, and entrepreneurs. I guess our audience, well, for sure, our audience has expanded over the years. So it was just kind of funny to hear it and for it to trick something, click something in my brain of like, oh, that's not the intro.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, things have changed over time, but it is interesting sometimes going back and reviewing things that you remember from a long time ago. And it definitely has a different tone or connotation with it. Benedict mentioned something about the fact that he was thinking about MicroConf Europe and how over time, like his view of the conference has changed, but also he has changed as a person after several years of coming to MicroConf, just based on the things that he's learned and the things that he's done. So although the conference in many ways has stayed the same, he has changed and evolved.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks for bringing him on, by the way. That was a bummer week. You and I couldn't discuss MicroConf Europe, but I felt like you guys did a really good job of kind of covering the topics.
Yeah, we ran a little bit out of time at the end there, and we didn't get a chance to cover into the attendee talks, which all of them I thought were fantastic, but it would have been nice to have a little bit more time to dive into those.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, that's, my updates for the week, I guess for the past few weeks, because I haven't been on the show for a bit due to the travel, really was going to Lisbon and really enjoyed getting to know Lisbon. It's a very livable city, obviously a lot more relaxed than like Barcelona. There's not as much there in terms of museums and sites to see, but we really enjoyed it. We got a great little Airbnb. I was there with my kids and a nanny, and we were just hanging out doing some travel. So it was a lot of fun. And then did MicroConf Europe, obviously, and then met Sherry in Rome the following week. And we all hung out there for, an additional week. And I just got back in town about 6 or 7 days ago. So it's good to be back in the States, but it's, travel's always fun. It like expands your mind. I find myself being way more creative and seeing things with new eyes. It was my second time back to Rome, really the whole family second time back to Rome. So it was neat to see our kids seeing the Colosseum and seeing these museums and these sites and remembering and talking about the last time we were there. And since they're older, it was so much easier. I think it was 3 or 4 years ago we took them. And so one of them was like 3 or 4. The youngest was 3 or 4 years old. And I just remember it was hard and it was tiring. And this trip was not that. Like it was so much more. It's like they're really good at travel now because they've done it, a few times. And even on the long flights and the time change, it was a 7 or 8 hour time difference. They just kind of handle it now. So it was a good trip. It was just a really relaxing 2 weeks. And I didn't know if it would be, right? You're traveling with 2 kids and a nanny and sometimes, the wife and sometimes not. And there were multiple plane flights and there was a 6 hour layover in Canada and we were all off time and we got tired at times, but it was overall such a worthwhile thing to do.
Awesome. Yeah, our kids are much better at travel these days than they used to be, but we still don't travel too much, I don't think. We went to my sister's house for Thanksgiving, and that's like a 5 hour drive or so, but it's not too bad. But we spent about 3 days there and then drove back.
How about you? What's been going on?
Well, my wife got me a Scotch whiskey advent calendar for Christmas.
Oh, man. Best gift ever.
Yeah. So that starts tomorrow, which I'm very excited about.
So an advent calendar, for those who aren't familiar, is it starts on December 1st, and there's like a little door that you open each day, and it's supposed to count you towards Christmas. And so like the original advent calendars, as far as I know, were like pieces of a nativity scene, which is, you know, the birth of Jesus. And you kind of open it and then you build the scene over the course of the month. But now there are like Lego, you know, advent calendars and chocolate advent calendars. And I had not heard of a Scotch one, but that is going to be awesome. So every morning, you're going to open it up and drink scotch with breakfast. Is that the idea?
I was going to wait until the evening, but yeah, there's
probably
24 different ones in here. So
that's going to be good. I know they like the little airplane bottles.
They are like little 50 milliliter, or actually I think it says 30 milliliter drams. So it's about like a shot or so. And, you know, it's like, I think it's just a regular size, but you know, there's 24 of them in here. And I saw the list of them, and a lot of them things that I've just never tried before. So it'll be really interesting to try for some of them.
For sure. 30 milliliters, Mike, that's like a third of a shot for me.
Yeah, I know. Well, it depends on your hand. I know.
So cool. Today we are going to be answering a slew of listener questions. We actually have 4 listener questions left over from MicroConf Europe. They're not listener questions, they're attendee questions. And you and I did a Q&A session at Europe, and we asked folks for questions in advance, and we ran out of time to answer them all. So maybe we'll start with those and then go into our store of questions. So the first question is from Mark, and he says, Rob, had you thought about integrating Drip with CRM platforms, something like Salesforce, MS Dynamics, other more enterprise things? Often a simple UI is missing there. We have discussed it. We do integrate with Pipedrive, with Close.io. We have a basic web to lead with Salesforce where you can just, a new subscriber comes in and you can just push them into Salesforce. I think we have Insightly as well. So we do have some CRM integrations. The thing is, I mean, there's a couple things to this question. One is, what do you mean by an integration? Do you just mean you can push from Drip, you know, when they hit a certain lead score, you can push them into your CRM? Because we already do that with several systems. But if you mean a full two-way integration where it's like syncing up data and tags and all this stuff, that kind of stuff is extremely, extremely complicated. The Salesforce alone would probably be about 9 months of business development and partnership and development work. I mean, a huge amount of effort. So that is one reason why I've not done it. Another reason is we don't focus, like our core market is not people with sales teams. You know, I mean, that's a whole other problem that other tools solve. And we focus on people who are driving digital commerce, right? So it's like e-commerce, people who are selling things online. If you take a credit card online, so we definitely work with SaaS apps and e-commerce sites and info marketers. But once you have a sales team, it's less in our core competency. And it's not something that we really want to double down on or spend the time on at this point.
I think one of the reasons this type of question comes up is because, like, once you put your product out there and people start using it, they're going to use it in ways that you didn't necessarily envision, and you make changes to like accommodate just, you know, what seem like reasonable requests, but they start down a path of allowing people to do things that the product wasn't necessarily designed to do from the very beginning, or, you know, you just didn't have the vision in it for it. And I'll give you a prime example of that, which is in Drip, you've got the lifetime value that you can assign to somebody. And that's kind of built right in. It's, I wouldn't say it's front center, but it is right there as kind of a standard option. And that kind of translates back to like a CRM where you say, oh, well, what's the lifetime value of these particular people? And it starts people down that path. And then, you know, it leads to questions like this. So like, how do you do the full two-way sync integration between, you know, Drip and whatever CRM that you have? But I think that's you have a great answer for it, which is really trying to focus on what the things are that you do best and leave the other things to somebody else, because you don't want to try and be everything to everyone.
Yep, you have to focus. Our next question is from Johannes, and he says, hey, at the breakfast this morning, we discussed driving traffic either through side projects, and that was part of what Alex Yumishev had talked about, which is kind of like engineering as marketing, right? It's building a tool that you launch on a weekend that does something, a website grader, an SEO grader, and then use that to drive leads, or through blog posts on subjects close to your product, but not mainly about your product. The questions came up about how to convert these visitors into paying customers. What is your experience there? And do you have any good advice? What do you think, Mike?
Well, I wouldn't say that I have any specific experience with taking a side project like that and trying to drive traffic. For context, because not everybody was there to listen to Alex's attendee talk, but he talked about how he had built a number of side projects and then through those side projects had linked back to his main business website and was ended up getting traffic to his main website and to converting those people into paying customers down the road just by virtue of the fact that like he's doing a lot of stuff in the open source community and people can browse that and they end up back at his website. So I think you have to treat it something as like a landing page or a lead generation mechanism as well. Like if people are there for a particular project that is in some way related to your primary product or set of products, then you have to think about like how would you get them to basically buy into the commercial offering that you have. Is it related? Like is the side project something that is tangential? Is it something that is a limited form of your main product? I think there's a lot of variability there based on what the side product actually is versus what your main business does. But thinking about those things and then using it as more or less like a landing page or a launching area where you get those people over to your site, and whether it's a specific landing page that you have, maybe giving them additional resources on your website, get them on your mailing list. That's really kind of an entry point into your sales funnel is what you're looking for. So I think that's probably the best approach for that. What do you think, Rob?
Yeah, I think it's all about if you're driving people. His question is specifically, if you're getting people to these blog posts or getting them to the side project, how do you then convert them to paid? It's all about email. It's all about getting their email address. Typically, these side project things, you know, ask for an email up front before they can use it, or you give them some results. And then if they enter their email, they get the rest of it. And then they're in your list. And there's the WP Engine website speed grader. There was the HubSpot website grader, which I think was like SEO stuff that Dharmesh built. And you had to enter emails for those. And then it was a nurture, an education. And then it gets you through to become interested in using the product ultimately.
Right. I was actually thinking of it from the standpoint of like you have a project on GitHub and, you know, it's like an open source offering versus what you had just mentioned, which I think was most of what Alex's talk was about, the online tools that are free and it is engineering is marketing at that point. You're absolutely right. Like you need to get that email address.
Our next question is from Paul, and he says, as a founder, I've found my emotions get entangled with the success of my business. Any advice for emotionally distancing yourself from your business so you can make decisions more rationally? It's obviously a longer answer, but my short answer is go to zenfounder.com, listen to the podcast, click the contact us link, and talk to Sherry Walling. That would be that's my quasi-joking answer, but it's actually like, it's a learned skill, and someone who's good at it can teach you. What do you think, Mike?
I agree with you that it is a skill. I have a hard time buying into the idea that there's one set of things that you can do and those set of things are going to work for everyone. I think that, you know, just based on who we are, our backgrounds, what sorts of things we're interested in, and how involved we are mentally in our business, and whether or not you're able to shut that off easily is going to greatly impact the things that will work for you and what won't. It's just like exercise, for example. Some people have a really easy time getting up and going to the gym. Other people don't. Same thing with going to sleep at night or a variety of other things, whether it's weight loss or what have you. Like there's different things that are going to work for each person. And there's probably a lot of experimentation that you're going to have to do to figure out what those things are that work for you. And you can get ideas from other people, but that doesn't mean that everything that you hear is going to work for you or that it's going to work as well for you as it did for them.
Yeah. This is really hard. This is the age-old question, and it's one that I think every founder probably struggles with. I know that I did, and I still do, and I never quite was able to completely conquer this. I don't think anybody is. I think that's part of being a good founder is that you care a lot, and that, you know, I used to joke, well, half joke, when my app's unstable, I'm unstable, and say things like my happiness is based on my MRR growth, and while that isn't totally true, it was kind of.
There's a lot of truth there.
There's a little more truth.
There's a lot of truth there.
Than I would care to admit. So yeah, I do think it's learning, it's becoming self-aware or being able to gauge when you are really stressed out and then asking why. I mean, this is what I'll tell you what I do. What I've learned is that when I'm stressed out or when I'm angry or when I'm frustrated, I I stop and I say, why do I feel this way? Is it something real or is it something that is fake, you know, that is manufactured, that someone said something stupid on Twitter that pissed me off, or someone, you know, is attacking this, or someone said something negative about my product and it hurt my feelings. And then I say, that is a very real thing, but do I need to still be thinking about that now? Or is it time to let that go? And this all sounds very simple, but this is how I cope with it. And then I will slowly be like, done. Like, I'm going to be done with that thing and I'm going to kind of make myself feel better. So it's actively thinking, why do I have this stressed out feeling? And also, a lot of people swear by it. I don't do it, but I did do meditation when the acquisition talks were going on, because I probably have never been that stressed in my entire life. And I would sit in the parking lot and I would meditate for 4 or 5 minutes each morning. And it's just listening to your breath and just being aware of what's going on with you, rather than thinking about, you know, having your mind race about other things. And that would help me get centered going into the day. And I know that a lot of people swear by that. So I think there's a lot of different skills. Deep breaths is something else I'll do. I'll sit there for 30 seconds and take 3 or 4 deep breaths if I want to calm myself down in the moment. And these are all like small things that I do when, you know, I'm actively stressed. I think trying to disconnect yourself from your business, as the original asker was asking, is you don't want it to train wreck you, you know, when things go sideways, but it should impact you in some way. I mean, you care about it a lot. It's kind of like, I don't know, losing a game that you're really interested in, or you know, you're playing soccer or you're playing chess or whatever, and you're really into it, and then you lose the game. I think you should be a good sport about it. But I personally believe that you should kind of be pissed off too, because I'm a competitor, you know, and you were playing the game to win. I mean, that's why I play games. So I think that if things are not going great in your startup, that you should feel a little stressed out. But it's finding a balance of not feeling so stressed out that it just dictates your day-to-day mood based on your, you know, your MRR growth or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's probably the more common issue, is being too vested in the outcome versus the journey along the way. And as you mentioned, that ties a lot back to the financial aspects of it. It's really hard to like disconnect yourself from it when things are not going well, or when not as well as you would like, really.
And our last question from MicroConf Europe, and then we'll get into some other questions, is from Alex. And he said, do you have any advice on time management as a solo founder? Is it better to dedicate specific days to specific skills, like marketing, for example?
I think going back to my comments about the fact that different things for managing your emotions are going to work differently for different people, I think the same kind of advice generally applies here as well. Like, the doing stuff on individual days is going to work for some people. Just doing time blocks, for example, is going to work for other people. I do think that there are certain types of tasks that you need to do that, you know, time boxing within a day is not necessarily going to work as well. So, for example, programming tasks or anything where you really need to get into deep focus and be able to spend a fair amount of time in order to make good progress on it, those are things that you can't spread throughout the day. You really need to be able to schedule those things better. Really, I mean, that's kind of the fundamental piece of time management, is being able to figure out when you're going to be effective at certain things and when, like, your decision-making skills are just totally shot and you really need to flip over to something else. You know, Robbie, you've talked about this in terms of, like, you know, managing your glucose levels throughout the day. And like, that's, it seems like an optimization, but being cognizant of when you are better at certain things than other times of the day is extremely important.
Yeah, we've covered this on the podcast, right? And we've had guests. I mean, we've talked about the time boxing approach that some people use. There's a couple of guys at my work that do that, and they really swear by it. I have done it when I'm derailed. Like, I do it as a short-term fix to get me back on track if I'm like unmotivated or if I'm struggling to figure out what to do. Personally, time management for me is, it's about priority management. If I know what I should be working on and then what I should be working on next, and I don't have to evaluate that every time I finish a task, I'm highly efficient. What derails me is if I finish something and then I look around and I go through my email and then I go to Trello and then I, you know, wind up going to Amazon or, you know, I just Twitter, and then I look around and I don't know what the hell I'm supposed to be doing. And that's where I lose. That's where I mismanage my time, is if I don't have these clear-cut priorities. And then, like you said, if I do have the clear-cut priorities, and it's the morning hours when I'm happen to be most productive, between, let's say, 8 and noon or 9 and 1, then that's it. You know, that's where I'm killing it. I try to push all of my meetings to afternoons. I try to push all of my calls to one day per week because those are distracting and interruptive for me, and it doesn't allow me to do deep work. So I think Alex's question of, is it better to dedicate specific days to specific skills, like marketing, for example, I think if that works best for you, that you should do it. I don't think I ever did that. Trying to think, yeah, I don't think I've ever blocked stuff off like that, like a whole day to just do marketing and then a whole day to just do development. But it was because when I had, let's say I have this Trello board of 20 tasks, and one was to whatever, go in and fix the forgot password thing that broke. And then the next one is to go start a Facebook ad campaign. For me, that's not a hard context switch if I've finished one and then I move on to Facebook. So I didn't feel like I had to stuff all the marketing stuff in one day. It was just about which priority it needed to be. Now, if I was switching back and forth between tasks when they're undone, then there's a big switching cost, right? But if I'm actually finishing and moving on to the next thing, I don't feel like I need to separate the disciplines to different days personally, but your mileage may vary for yourself. So thanks again for the questions, guys. I'm glad we were able to get through the last four here on the podcast. Our next question is actually not a question. It is a thanks to us from Nathan. He says, thanks for all the motivation. Thanks for the show. It's been really motivating to get me started on my journey into the world of startups. I haven't released a product yet, but I'm working on building a public reputation and a mailing list. I just released a plugin for the Craft CMS, which I use to run my personal site, because I couldn't find a good way to add events and tag emails in my Drip account for people who filled out my contact form. Releasing something, even though I'm not selling it directly, feels amazing. Can't wait to release even more things in the future. Thanks so much.
Thanks for that, Nathan. I find it interesting that, you know, the first thing he did was integrate it into Drip, especially given the other question about CMSs and you integrating with CMSs from Microsoft.
That one was CRMs, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. Sorry.
Different TLA, three-letter acronym.
Yep.
All right. Our next question is about how to take over duties from your contractor. It's from John Hollows. And he says, howdy, I started my SaaS at a time when I didn't know much about front-end development, but I was focused on back-end data handling and product decisions. I hired a contractor and it's been great, but it's become a roadblock to development. I can't update the front-end without sending him a Slack message and waiting a few days for a reply. Ooh, that's a bummer. He says, I've gotten good enough that I can now do it myself. Could you cover how to manage scaling down or letting go a contractor? I foresee requesting things to be more documented, then gradually taking back ownership of different aspects while giving him modular work, like creating a front-end module that handles a new feature. Thanks, and keep up the great work. What do you think?
I think this is an interesting one just because a lot of people probably find themselves in this situation, whether it's for financially related reasons or because somebody just isn't working out and they want to basically take over control or responsibility for the things so that they can move faster. And this, I think, is a really common problem if you're early on and you've got money to spare and you're hiring people and maybe they're not putting in the time because you obviously, like, you don't have enough money to pay them full time, but at the same time, like, you're kind of beholden to their schedule. So even if you want to move faster, you can't necessarily do it. And I think that it's just a very common situation that people find themselves in. And the key to this is not to be put in a situation where you have to go back to them afterwards and start asking for documentation and start, I'll say, cleaning things up and putting things in order so that you could transition from one person to another, that person being them and transitioning it back to you. One thing you can do is you can go through yourself and start understanding it. Because if you really are going to take it over, then you have to understand it to begin with. And you going through and doing some of that documentation work yourself might be at least a good start. But you also want to put together, I would say, a framework or a process for how the documentation should be put together, like what sorts of processes need to be put in place or documented so that when you get to a point where after you've taken it over and you've been doing it and you need to shift onto something else and you need to take this and hand it off, then you've got all the documentation put together and you've been keeping it up to date. Because if you get everything documented and then you take it over and do stuff for 6 months or a year, but you don't maintain the documentation, you're going to be back exactly where you were when you first took it over. So it's important that the stuff that you're putting in place are things that you are going to continue doing as part of the process and you are not opposed to doing them. Because if you don't, it's just going to fall apart for you later on.
Yeah, the way I would approach this, I'm going to assume you have a good relationship with your contractor, and you're going to have to judge this if you tell the contractor totally honestly up front, hey, I'm going to look at taking over all the dev work. Could we start by having you create some documentation and then have you walk me through the, you know, the thing to kind of get me up to speed. And then I'm slowly going to take it over, you know, up over time over the next 3 to 6 months, and let's just transition it. If you feel like you can do that, great. Most of the contractors I've worked with have no problems with that. If you think that the contractor's going to be kind of a pain in the ass about it, then you can take a different tact and you can let him or her know, hey, I'm going to be taking over some of the front-end development work. I just find that I have more time and I want to do some blah, blah, blah. And so you don't really say that you're going to basically be letting him go, you know, in 6 months, but you just kind of say, hey, I realize that we may, or you could also say, you know, we maybe think about bring on more contractors or other people, and I really just want some documentation. Can we just start, you know, put together some documentation and then walk me through it? And this is pretty standard stuff as a contractor. I would totally expect someone to come to me and say this. So I think your thinking process here is right, that you're going to want some documentation. You're probably going to want to walk through. You're going to want to slowly take over more, slowly shrink the contractor's kind of sphere of ownership, and then eventually just take over all the work. My guess is if the contractor is pretty good, you're always going to have some lower priority stuff that can wait a few days. And then there's the high priority stuff. But if the contractor's solid and knows the code base and has delivered for you, I bet that by the time you get to the place where you're doing all the front end work and you're doing the high priority stuff that needs to get done quick, that you're going to have enough lower priority stuff that still needs to get done that you may want to actually keep the contractor around. You know, whether it's at the amount of hours they're doing now or fewer, it's always good to have another resource to help out with this stuff. So I think there could be a lot of truth in the statement of, I want to learn this so that we can kind of share the burden rather than you taking over everything. So I hope that helps. Thanks for the question. Our next question is from Tim. It's about improving conversions. He says, I've been tracking signups across the board, and about 50% of the people that come onto my pricing page follow through to sign up and they use the app. However, the number of converting paying users is very low. So he has a trial, obviously. He says, I'm talking under 1%. So his trial to paid is under 1%. I'm going to assume with a 50% sign-up rate of people who visit the pricing page that he is not asking for credit card in advance of the trial. Can you point me to a resource I can use to take the first step to tackling this problem? And instead of pointing him to a resource, Mike, why don't we just become the resource?
So he has two different products here. One of them is called Article Insights, and the other one's called SEO Content Machine. And I don't know which one he's specifically referring to, so it's probably a little bit difficult to drill directly into those. But there's two approaches I would take. One is to take a look at the people who have converted and ask them why they started paying, what was important to them, maybe analyze how long they stick around and see if their lifetime value is extremely low for what you would expect. Maybe you expect them to stick around for 3 months or 6 months, and they're staying around for a month or two. That's kind of a warning sign that either they're signing up for something and they thought that they were getting something else, or it's just really not delivering the value that they thought that they were going to get out of it. The other thing you can do is you can go and start talking to those people who have signed up, but if you put an offer in front of them, for example, let's say that after, you know, 7 days that they could convert into a paid account, ask the people who didn't why they didn't, or what were the biggest turnoffs to them. Now, whether that's you ask them to respond to an email or, you know, just get on a call with them. I mean, if you can get on a call with them, great. But I understand that a lot of them are probably not going to. But if you've got 99% of them who are not converting into paid, then you've got a lot of opportunities to get them onto a call. And it's really about understanding what it is that they thought that they were signing up for and what value that they thought that they were going to get, what their position is. So are they just like kicking the tires? Like, is the reason you have really high sign-up rate because they're just tire kickers and it's free, so they figured, what the heck, I just throw my email address in there? Or is it that they actually had a business problem that they were trying to solve? And that's the part that you're really trying to get at, is like, what are the pain points that they're actually trying to solve? And does the product actually deliver those things? Or is it that you think that it does, but the reality is that their situation or the problem is a little bit more tangential than your product delivers on?
Yeah, I'd recommend checking out a talk that I gave back in, I'm guessing it was 2013 at MicroConf. So it's going to be on Vimeo, and it's called How to 10X in 15 Months. Or it might be How I 10X'd in 15 Months. But it's basically the story of acquiring Hittail and then 10X'ing the revenue. And some part of that that had a pretty noticeable impact was getting the trial to paid numbers way up. And I did that using email sequences and event-based emails that would hit people up if they didn't get onboarded. And then I'm trying to think that I should have had in-app stuff. I don't know that I did, but that would have been another one. It's just about getting people onboarded. I think your approach, Mike, of talking to people has got to be the first step, just to try to suss out why are people not doing it. I do think that adding email reminders is going to absolutely have a pretty substantial impact, even before you know what people, you know, why they're getting onboarded versus not getting onboarded. I still think that email will have an impact if you're not sending any today. So that's where I would start. See, I enjoy these kinds of problems, right? Because it's like, you know that you're a lot lower than you should be, and it's just a puzzle. It's like, how do you get that one up to 3% or up to 5%? And even, I think, what is the range? 5 to 15% for no credit card? It's somewhere in there. Maybe it's even 5 to 20. So you should be able to substantially increase this. And it's just figuring out where the break is. And if you can fix that, like, this is how you scale a business, right? This is where you go from trudging along, growing at 100 or a couple hundred bucks a month to suddenly really, really being able to hockey stick this thing if the numbers are right. Our last question for the day is from Alex Sommerfeld. And he says, hey, Mac and Rob, this one is more for Rob. What do you think about the newly launched drip service from Kickstarter? And it's D.RIP is the service. In essence, what's interesting is it's not actually a launched product that Kickstarter launched. It was a startup that started after Drip. So Drip, basically, we broke ground on code in 2012. We launched in 2013. And I think it was sometime in mid to late 2014 that this company called Drip launched, and it was a music social network, and it was a startup that raised a bunch of money, and they bought the drip.com domain name, and because I couldn't afford it, I bought it from a squatter. And once I saw that they owned it, I remember telling Derek, like, I'm just counting the months, 15 to 18 months, they're going to be out of business, right? Because it's a music social network. The odds of it working are just minuscule. And you typically raise funding for 15 to 18 months of expenses. So sure enough, sometime in, don't quote me on this, but it was sometime in 2015, I think, they basically went under. And I actually contacted their CTO and their CFO and the, you know, all the people involved, and eventually was talking about trying to buy the domain name. But it turned out that, like, Kickstarter had basically just acquired the assets of Drip, you know, of that social network, and some reason didn't buy the domain name, or I don't know if they didn't want to, or if it didn't come with the package, or what happened. So the drip.com at that point got separated from this music social network, but Kickstarter acquired the assets. And I don't know what the assets of it, if it was a team of people or if there was any type of software, but in essence, they turned it into, it's like Patreon competitor. That's what it is. So Kickstarter's kind of launching a, you know, a way to do kind of subscription giving to support creators. And so this name has been around for a long time, kind of in bizarre context. Now, the end of this story is my Drip got acquired by Lead Pages, and we bought the drip.com domain name maybe, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago. And now if you go to drip.com, it's our website, and all our email addresses are now using drip.com. So, I mean, I don't know how I feel about it. It sucks to have two things with the exact same name. You can't trademark the name Drip because it's too generic. I actually tried to do that back in 2014, 2015. And, you know, it is what it is. I mean, there's going to be some confusion. We have the .com. So I feel like that's kind of a win. It all depends on, you know, how, given that we're not competitors at all, Drip does seem to just be, it's being used, that word and phrase is being used in marketing, and it's being used in just to mean something that is released over time, because that's what this is, right? Is subscription. It's like payments to creators over time versus, you know, dripping out email over time. So I don't know that I have strong opinions on it. I'm not terribly offended by it. I wasn't super happy when they launched 3 years ago, but I'm kind of over it just because they've been around and I've watched the whole thing play out. You have other thoughts on it?
I mean, it's interesting that the color schemes and everything else are extremely similar. And it's just like Drip, where you work, is Lead Pages. It's capital D and they've got a lowercase d and their I is upside down. But other than that, it's just like it just looks very similar.
Yeah, I think when you think of Drip, you're going to tend to use blue. So we both use blue, you know, and startup blue is a common thing anyway. So
yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can foresee like there could be just a lot of confusion, to be honest, which sucks. But, you know, there's all the, with as many domain names as there are, it's like there's only so much you can do. Well, I think that about wraps us up for today. If you have a question, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsforrestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
So welcome to the Startups for the Rest of Us after show.
Is this like the happy hour?
This is like the happy hour. This is when you and I BS about things like movies we've watched and or interesting stories, funny stories about our in-laws visiting over the holidays, stuff like that. I'm a fan of there's this podcast called Stacking Benjamins, and it's kind of a personal finance and investing show, and it's fun. You know, they tell bad jokes and stuff, but they do this after show. And what they say, and I think what we should do here, is don't talk about the after show on Twitter. Like, the after show doesn't exist. If you stumbled into it and you hear it, just listen to it and consider yourself kind of in the inner circle. A lot of people will, when the show ends and there's the silence, they're going to leave the episode and never hear this. So this stuff is never going to be applicable to startups. It's not going to be about growing your business. It's going to be us kind of BSing for 5 or 10 minutes. And it won't be every episode either. We just don't always have time to do it. But this week, I know we have time to talk about a movie that I just watched with my 10-year-old. Shit, he's 11. It's a movie I watched with my 11-year-old.
Oh, you know, you can get away with that now because it's the after episode. Hopefully Sherry won't listen to it.
I know. I just...
You could have gotten away with it. You could have just gone. Nobody would have thought about anything. You know, you'd have been good.
Can't keep them all straight. So Hobbit episode 3, Battle of the Five Armies. My son and I had seen episodes 1 and 2 in the theater. And when 3 came out, I remember wanting to see it and we got busy and then I never did. And then I heard kind of mixed reviews about it. I've loved the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy. I used to watch the crazy rotoscope cartoons back in the 80s, the cartoon movies of Lord of the Rings, and then I've read The Hobbit. My son's read The Hobbit. You know, he's read most of Lord of the Rings as well. So we're fans, and we're fans of the fantasy genre. But I saw the episode 3 with my son for the first time just a few days ago. So before I talk about it, did you see it in the theater? Did you see all of them?
I don't remember whether I saw it in the theater. I mean, I do own it, so I can't remember whether I saw it in the theater or not. I don't think that I did.
Did you watch it with your kids?
Yes, my kids have definitely seen it.
Got it. All right. So what'd you think? What'd you think of the whole Hobbit? Because I'm assuming you really, really liked the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Is that suffice to say?
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was good. Like I took the time and actually read the book itself, which is painful. Oh my God.
Yep,
is
it, like, I understand. That's why I've never read it.
Oh, it's bad.
Yeah, it's just long, right? It's just long and treacherous, and there's a lot of, it's long-winded, and there's the songs, and there's all that. Is that what you mean by it?
Well, it's not just that. It's just like there's long periods of absolutely nothing happening, and it's very difficult to stick with it. Like, I've read through it just because I wanted to be able to say, yeah, I read this and got through the whole thing, but at the same time, I also recognize, like, you have to put it in the dedication to actually be able to do that, because it's just hard. It's a long slog. But that said, like, I feel like the original Lord of the Rings trilogy for the movies tracked really well to the book itself. But when you get into the Hobbit series, there's a lot of, I'll say, creative licensing where a lot of things didn't happen directly in the Hobbit, because the Hobbit was just like the one book, right? Wasn't it?
And it was, yeah. And it wasn't even that long.
Yeah. And they made 3 movies out of it, which some people were offended by, but at the same time, there's all these other notes and stuff that Tolkien had written down. So,
right.
I don't know. It's,
that's the deal, right? I think he took some stuff from the Silmarillion, and I mean, Tolkien had the whole world designed there. So that's the challenge. Is I felt like The Hobbit should have been 2 movies. It felt long at 3. It just felt really drawn out to me. The third movie, I didn't love. The Battle of the Five Armies, that was okay. I think it was the worst of the 6, you know, if I think about them. I really, I enjoyed, really, really liked Lord of the Rings. And then I like the first Hobbit a lot, and then the second one a little bit less, and then Battle of the Five Armies. It's like, I'm glad I saw it to conclude the whole, you know, the whole tale, but I do agree with the kind of mixed reviews about it. And my son was super upset when, this is a spoiler, skip ahead 30 seconds if you don't want to hear a spoiler, but some of the main character, you know, some of the main dwarves get killed towards the end. And he was really, he hasn't seen many movies where that happens. I think you and I growing up in the 80s, like that happened in movies, but like it's less common with the stuff that he watches. So it was pretty, he's like, I wish I'd never seen that movie. He was all upset.
Yeah, I guess I can see that. Yeah, I agree. I think that they definitely could have done it in two movies and been done with it. You know, obviously like there was the one Hobbit book. So like they could have done it in one if they really wanted to, but the fact that Lord of the Rings was so successful and they made so much money from it, it made sense for them financially to try and make it into three movies. But I'm sure that they got paid for it. that's not the issue. The issue is like whether or not it was a good artistic effort. And from a visual standpoint and all the stuff that factors into like how much I'll say R&D they had to do and how to do like accomplish some of the special effects that they wanted to, they did a great job, but you didn't need a third movie for the story to be able to do that.
And then you said you saw a movie in the theater.
Yeah, so I took the kids to see Thor Ragnarok recently. And so we took the kids, and this probably relates to anyone who has kids and has said, hey, I think that they would like this movie because, you know, I watched it when I was a kid and I loved it. And you watch it with the kids, and then suddenly you start to see things as a parent or when you're older that you did not notice or realize when you were a kid. So we were watching Thor Ragnarok, and afterwards we get home and the kids go off and do their own thing. And my wife looks at me and she says, what was it? It was, I'm not looking forward to having to explain what an orgy is to them. Because there was a scene in the movie where the characters stole this ship and they were trying to get away and they were getting shot at. And so they're like looking around for the weapons on the ship. And they're like, you know, yeah, there's no weapons on this ship. This is so-and-so's orgy ship. And so I can see a time down the road when we get the movie and the kids are watching it at home and they have more time to kind of absorb all of the movie that they hear that and they look at us and say, what's an orgy? And my wife's not looking forward to answering that question.
For sure. Yeah, that's funny. So had you seen the movie before? Or did you see it all together?
Yeah, we all saw it together. And that's the danger of seeing any movie at all. Like, you know, you don't know what to expect.
Right. The verbiage can come through. I have not seen it, so no spoilers, but what was your, you got, you know, five stars, four stars? I heard it's quite good, but what did you think? Did you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say it's either four or five stars. It depends on, you know, like how into the Marvel universe you are and into the story. Like I'm
into the Marvel
universe. Yeah, you'll probably give it four or five as well. It's hard to rank the movies against each other when you, like, if you're that much into it, I would probably rank most of the Marvel movies that I've seen either four or five stars. And when they're all that close together, there's not really a differentiation between them. You almost have to rank like how good they are in relation to other ones. I liked it better than the second Thor movie. I'm trying to think of what ones I would put it behind.
I mean, like the Avengers 1 and 2 at least were really good, right? 1, 2, and 3?
They were, but I've also realized that going back and watching them, if you watch it the first time, you think it's fantastic, and then you watch it again or watch it a couple more times, and some things get stale. So like your mental ranking of those things tends to go down over time, or at least for me it does. You know, so like another prime example of that is the new Ghostbusters movie that came out, and I watched the original one kind of at about the same time, and I'm like, yeah, not so good. But I remember like thinking, hey, the original Ghostbusters was absolutely awesome. But then I went back and watched it. I'm like, yeah, I've seen this so much that like everything's, you know, it's a little bit stale.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. So, very good, sir.
So I think that makes it hard to compare to like the original Avengers or the second Avengers movie or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. But
it was very good though. I would definitely highly recommend it.
It's on my list.
Awesome.